Hello, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Operation Tango Romeo, the Trauma Recovery Podcast for veterans, first responders, and their families. We are on a mission to save lives and relieve pain by making help for PTS injuries easily accessible, with a vision of a world where the path to recovery is clear. Please support this mission by subscribing to and rating the show on your favorite podcast channel, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Anchor, or anywhere else. By doing so, you'll help others find the help which just might save their life. Also, please help by sharing a link to the show on all of your social media channels every time a new episode drops. And always remember to recover out loud. And we're rolling live for another edition of Operation Tango Romeo, the Trauma Recovery Podcast for veterans, first responders, and their families. Today, I am so very happy to have Catherine Christensen on the show. Been chasing her for a while and finally caught her by the toe. And we've got a big conversation to have today. And luckily, I've heard all the arguments on both sides. I understand the division within the military community, both veterans and active serving, on both sides of the issues that we're going to be covering. So I'll be a little bit devil's advocate and be throwing things at you left and right so that we can just get down to the bottom line. Like, what's the truth and what is the situation actually, and go from there. Catherine, yeah. Thank you so much for making the time today. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and you can't be any tougher than a courtroom. So,
I am your friend. I am your friend.
I call my opposing counsel friend, but sometimes you know that friend comes out a little tight.
Yeah, friend.
Friend.
Well, it was our mutual friend Dave Morrow that had you on, and I thought, well, shit, if you can get her, I'm going to get her. And so we have you on here, and it's interesting the division within the veteran community. People that I absolutely love and have known forever that are of the mindset that, hey, we've all had our fair share of jabs. And everybody always brings up the gauntlet that we got to run. So prior to a tour, you go through the ungodly gauntlet. You take off your shirt and you have people on each side of you and jab, 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 all the way down the line. You feel like shit for the next 3 days, but you recover. At least everybody did that I knew about. You even had to do PT the next day, even though you're like, oh, I don't feel so good. And you carry on. And for the people that have multiple tours, they had to run the gauntlet every single time before a tour. And we had this little yellow book of vaccines that a mile long. So anybody that served in the military and has a deployment, they have more jabs in them than any member of the regular public, unless they are like Doctors Without Borders or something, and they travel to Africa all the time. So let's start there. When I ran the gauntlet way back in 1994, and before that, even joining the military, they gave you a bunch of extra jabs. Was that mandatory? Did I have the right to refuse the gauntlet? And if not, why not?
Well, prior to the Kipling case, which was when someone was deploying to Iraq and refused the anthrax vaccine for that deployment, it was not really talked about. You just did what you did. After Kipling, it became a fact that under Section 126 of the National Defense Act, the Chief of Defense Staff can order you to have a vaccination of any kind, and then you have a right to say no. You would be court-martialed, and if you have a reasonable excuse not to accept the vaccination, then you are acquitted and you're not required to have it. So that would have meant that under this scenario of the COVID-19, if someone had gone to a court-martial and said, here are my religious beliefs, it violates my religious beliefs to take it. Besides that, there are people in the Canadian Armed Forces who have zero vaccinations and are still serving, they probably would have been acquitted, and that would have set a big precedent. Here's the other key, though, is that the Chief of Defense Staff did not use Section 126 of the National Defense Act. He had the right to. He chose not to. Probably because I have two theories on that. One is that the JAG couldn't have handled 3,000 to 5,000 courts martial. They're too small to handle that many. The other is they couldn't risk setting a stronger precedent than Kipling, because Kipling was not the strongest case. Certainly one of these would have been, because under the Supreme Court of Canada, religious belief is very clearly defined by our senior court. And I got to tell you, what happened in the Canadian Armed Forces after the directives were issued violates that law. Unbelievably.
Right around 1986, the rights of serving members changed. Mm-hmm. It might have been exactly 86. So it was the Human Rights Act got enforced. And because prior to that, I guess we weren't humans. But the idea, I mean, we're not civilians, so therefore civil rights don't apply, but human rights still did. And that was enforced.
Oh, we're going to talk about whether civil rights apply or not.
Okay, but, sure.
Go ahead.
The change that happened in the military, because they used to be able to hit you with a pay stick, crack you across the knuckles, corporal punishment, they punch you in the face in battle school if they thought that that was a good idea, and there wasn't bugger all you could do about it. But in 86, they said, that's a bit much. You know, let's roll that back, perhaps punching you in the face or smashing you across the shins with a stick. Maybe that's not necessary to make you a good soldier. So they changed it right around 86. And that change that happened, does that affect mandatory jabs with the COVID jab now? Is there any relationship there?
There is, because, and this is where the civil rights come in.
Okay.
Because when you do swear yourself in under the oath of service, you do not give up your rights as a Canadian citizen.
Okay.
The Charter of Rights and Freedoms still apply to you. You still have bodily autonomy. You still have a right to your religion. You still have a right, all those rights. You do not give up. And the best example I can give you is that if you were arrested on a criminal offense, you still have a right to a lawyer. You still have a right to a fair trial, et cetera, et cetera. Those are ordinary rights for every Canadian citizen. You don't give those up because you put a uniform on.
Then how can you be court-martialed for refusing a jab?
Because there's under the National Defense Act, he has the authority to order it.
Okay.
And you have the right, to say no, and then they can charge you under Section 126, and then you have a right to bring your defense. And I can tell you that based on the Supreme Court of Canada law, you would have a right to a defense to say it's against my religion, or I have a medical reason that I can't take it, or I have bodily autonomy and I can refuse this. Now, what's happened is that some of the members did grieve the directive, and it has reached the external review committee, it's now on the desk of General Ayer as CDS for final authority. The external review committee now on 7 occasions has identified that he should have used 126 and that the Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was violated. And under the National Defense Act, the Chief of Defense Staff cannot issue an order that violates the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
So it was an unlawful order. It's an unlawful order.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Which is what they couldn't risk if they had proceeded with 126 instead of the administrative process leading to 5F.
So because it was emergency use authorization only, is that what makes it an illegal order? An unlawful order?
What it does is because he's ordering people without informed consent and violating their right to bodily autonomy to say no for repercussions. It's a temporary measure. He says it right in it. No matter what directive 1, 2, 2 amendment or 3, it says that it's a temporary thing. And he had permanent consequences, which was a 5F release. He was told, actually.
And what is a 5F release?
A 5F release is unsuitable for further service. So it's the same one that they would give you if you were a drunk or a drug addict that couldn't be rehabilitated.
So dishonorable discharge, basically.
It used to be. Only recently did they change it to an honorable one. But okay. In the military community, it's dishonorable. you're not in a good crowd for a 5F release.
Does that erase your veterans' rights and your veterans' benefits?
No, it doesn't. No.
Okay, because some forms of release, you get out, you're not considered a veteran.
Right. The 5F, it does acknowledge that you're a veteran. However, if in 2012, they did a whole thing with some of the pay, the severance pay. You could choose not to take it in 2012 and take it upon release. If you're a 5F release, you lose that, which for some people was tens of thousands of dollars. So the people that made the decision not to take it and stick to what they felt was right, some of them sacrificed a lot, not just careers, but financial losses. And the mental health part of it, I can't even begin to touch on.
In the middle of the pandemic, Theo Fleury and I went up to Edmonton to Canada Connect, which is sort of a hub, what the Legion is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And we did a speaking gig up there. And there were roughly 40 soldiers that were getting booted out of the military over this issue because they didn't want to get the jab. And one of the fellas I spoke with, about 23 years of service, 23 years. And one of the super soldiers, like one of the legendary people, like Free Fall Commando, all the high speed, low drag courses that are highly, highly respected, member of my regiment, the PPCLI. And what he told me is that even if I bent the knee and took the jab right now, my career is still over.
Yes, that's true.
My career is over regardless, just because I put up any kind of a fuss whatsoever. Now, for somebody like that, let's say they change their mind, but they're still being punished by career suicide. Do those people have a claim in court?
Yes, they do. So the loss mass tort that I've brought, it's not a class action, it's a mass tort. 330 people. Here's the thing, is that everybody tries to say it's a COVID-19 lawsuit. It actually is not. It is a mass tort that, to sum it all up, there's 30 different claims, but to sum it all up into a sentence, it's about abuse of power.
Right.
It's about how the Canadian Armed Forces are abusing their own people. And what happened is that in October of 2021, the Chief of Defense Staff brought in a directive that was unlawful. And there was a whole cascade of things that happened after that, which makes it really nice for me to be able to go into a courtroom and say, here's 330 examples of what the chain of command did to their own people from October 21 to today. And you know, it's much easier for me as a lawyer to tell that story and use that example than trying to pull something from 1990, 2003, 2016. You know, those are okay, but I've got hundreds of stories of people being abused by the chain of command and an unlawful order on top of it. Some people were physically tortured to try and get them to comply.
How so?
Left outside in the cold for 3 months in the winter of 2021 to 2022. Made to arrive early so that everyone could taunt him on his way out, on their way out. Giving him assignments outside the window so they could taunt him through the window and tell him how stupid he was.
Left outside in the cold so that because of social distancing. The idea?
No. He was left outside in the cold as punishment.
Was told that this is what you get for resisting?
Yes. Yep. He lost 20 pounds of muscle mass, mentally broken. He lasted 3 months. I don't know about you, but that's the kid I'd want in the trenches with me, that he could withstand that physical torture. I call it torture because there's no other word for it. That major that ordered it and the RSM that allowed it, if they did that to a prisoner of war, they'd be in the Hague for a war crime.
Are you able to name the major and any of the people?
I can't name the major right at this moment, but he is one of the plaintiffs, Frederick Villeneuve, Normand, and he is listed in the statement of claim. And of all the stories, he's the one that everyone nominates as the top number one abusive story. Now, the RCR in Petawawa, they're the ones that were put into a tent in December of 21, and were told that if they wanted heat, they needed to be vaccinated. Story started to leak out, and CTV News showed up on the base, so they quickly put heat back into their tent for them. You were talking about how things were supposed to change in 86. Nope. I have young women that were cleared the wardroom. She'd just come back from maternity leave, from stress leave. So they already knew she was vulnerable. Cleared the wardroom, sent everybody home except her, put her in a room with four senior officers who were all male, and made her stay there until she agreed to sign a piece of paper that said she wouldn't follow a lawful order. This is on top of all the sexual misconduct stuff that's going around at the time. I honestly have to tell you that I see the sexual misconduct issue as not a separate issue. It's all abuse of power. The Canadian Armed Forces has a really big problem with thinking they're untouchable and that they can do whatever they want and nobody's going to stop them. Well, guess what? 330 people have stood up and said, you have to answer this in a court.
One of my friends posted in response without even reading what it was that I posted, I'm sure. And it was actually the show with you and Dave Morrow. And I had shared it. And basically trying to trivialize it, saying, oh, it's only like 0.0000013% of the forces that that were refusing.
The thousands of people I've talked to in the past 2 years would tend to disagree with
me. Would tend to disagree. So 330 had the courage to join the mass tort. Do you have an idea about how many got the jab? I mean, it's really tough to get this number, but do you have an inkling of how many people within the CF decided to get the jab against their will?
I would say at least half.
Half.
At least, if not more than that. Because now that the mass tort has become public, I'm hearing from more and more. And in the lawsuit are people who are fully vaccinated. But they did it. They were under coercion without informed consent. This is all abuse. This is all, I can't wait to ask the Surgeon General. He's a doctor first. He has a license as a doctor. I want to ask him what he calls informed consent, because there wasn't any informed consent here.
So
that's just one issue, right? I mean, people focus on how many dollars they're asking for, but there are 30 claims, and it's not about money for most of my people. Most of my people, this is about trying to fix what's wrong.
Well, the money seems a little light. 330 plaintiffs, 500 mm-hmm. million seems like a lot. It's more than a million apiece. But that's light. If you're looking at people with, say, 23 years in, like the fellow mm-hmm. that I met, was 2 years from pension, and now no pension for you. So a 23-year investment mm-hmm. gone, and nothing you can do about it. And there's no time in your life to do another 25 years of work to get a pension. And even if there was, you're going to be 80 by the time you're able to collect. So you're never going to retire.
Right. And if you've got a 5F, you can't have a federal job.
You can't even work.
To try and get that pension, you know, to build that pension up again. You can't even transfer those skills to the federal government.
You can't even you can't even join the RCMP after to continue on.
No. Not with a 5F. Nope.
And how many releases, 5F releases, have happened over this?
Now, here's what you need to know, is that they've disguised it really well. Because they were overwhelmed by how many 5Fs they were actually getting. So DMCA, Director of Military Careers, couldn't handle the flood, the tsunami that came at them of releases. So they started looking for any excuse to release them under a medical release, a 3B, and ship them over to DMedPol, so that, because that was a different release area, they could take some of them. So, you sprained your ankle in 2015. You sprained your ankle? Great. We're going to get you out on a 3B release. That's what it came down to at one point, the panic. To get these people out. And the truth is, they didn't get everyone. Some people, Directive 3 comes along, it doesn't get rid of the mandate, but it allows them to come back to work. And they are, so they're working now, but they're getting bankruptcy postings now. And their careers are over. We've got instructor pilots that are stuck on desks.
There's probably the most famous veteran that was drummed out of the military was a member of JTF. And he's now been on the Sean Ryan show talking about this. And because you, his name is Dallas Alexander, I'm going to be meeting him this Friday. He's doing an event with Theo Fleury and Jamie Salleh. So I've got my tickets. I'm going to the show.
He's one of my plaintiffs, actually.
Okay. So he's a part of it. But it's such an interesting example that not only was he a JTF person, and for anybody outside of Canada or anybody who's not familiar with what that means, it means a tier one operator. So the most highly trained soldiers in the world are tier one. The equivalent in the state is not the Navy SEALs, that's tier two, but only SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force, and that's about it. There might be a third one, but Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, that's the equivalent of JTF as far as the level of training. So they are the best of the best of the best. And part of the selection, a large part of the selection, when you select somebody like this, is their ability for independent thought, their ability for critical thought, and to stay calm under fire. That is, if you can't do that, you don't make selection. And making selection is extremely difficult. It's more than just the incredible physical fitness. So they make you jump through these hoops to be a critical thinker, and then they get drummed out to be a critical because you're a critical thinker. And JTF has been decimated over this.
Yes, it has. I can tell you, they were either vaccine injured or they were drummed out. Our most experienced operators and helicopter pilots for special forces, they were either vaccine injured or drummed out.
In the States, there's really good statistics on the vaccine injuries, and the numbers are gargantuan.
They are here too.
Well,
if you have the real stats, because I've got more people listed for a lawsuit that's coming on vaccine injury, because VAX says that it's not service related if they're vaccine injured. That's going to be challenged. I'm going to challenge that, but I have more people on that wait list than CAF says were injured. And I can also tell you that the vaccines killed more members of the CAF than COVID did.
Do you have any idea about how many deaths were caused by the COVID jab?
I know of at least 6 at this point.
Okay.
And they're all young men between 35 and 40, and they died in their sleep.
So people that definitely would not have died from COVID.
Nope. We're talking Patricia, who had deadlifted 600 pounds 2 days before. We're talking a helicopter pilot down east who had myocarditis, had been cleared to fly, and 2 weeks later was dead in his sleep.
So you're aware of 6 so far. And what other than death, which is pretty extreme, what other kinds of vaccine injuries, what do those look like? What have you seen?
Lots of myocarditis, career-ending myocarditis, lots of neurological symptoms. We've got Guillain-Barre syndrome. We've got people that cannot cognitively function.
Brain fog, to
the point where they live 20 minutes from the base and they fell asleep on the first stop sign on the base trying to get home after a half day of work, that were perfectly physically fit and being deployed before the injections. We've got strokes.
A friend of mine I had to bury. I actually used to look after him. I was a respite worker. And he's a developmentally challenged man in his mid-50s, otherwise healthy. Had a massive stroke 6 days after jab number 2. And then survived the stroke for about a year before he finally succumbed. And so he suffered for a full year before he died. And I physically buried him. Like, I was using a shovel and buried him. Was part of the crew that did that. And to say that this is rare is, just not true.
Nope. The statistics are high. But then we know that because in August of 21, it was well known throughout the world that Moderna was a very bad choice for young men especially. And that was what CAP was giving people was Moderna.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I've got some serious questions for the Surgeon General there, because as a doctor, he should have known. That's the key.
Should have.
Why did he not research what was about to be jabbed into people's arms?
Well, for the deaths, what I'm seeing is criminal negligence causing death, which is a criminal charge. So back to the American numbers. The American numbers are meticulously watched for seeing if you are battle ready or not. Are you able to... are you fit for service or not? And so there are critical illnesses that they monitor. They monitor very, very tight, and they know their numbers. As soon as the jabs started getting dished out, rates of cancer were like 500% up. What were some of the other ones? MS was a big one. Neurological orders were 10x'd. So 10 times more neurological disorders, and the military has been decimated with injuries that, and it's all directly after, like they're like everybody's fine, predictable numbers for the last 50 years. And then those predictable numbers across the board all spiked after the jab. But it's difficult to trace because correlation doesn't equal causation, but, have you seen something similar in the Canadian military, and do you have any idea about the numbers?
I don't have an idea about the numbers, but I have seen it happening. The official numbers we're not going to be able to ever get in the Canadian military because, and I've got military doctors who are not only plaintiffs, but others that will testify that they were told not to report vaccine injuries. They were told to put them as something else. When one asked how to report them, because she was going to do it, even though they told her not to, they said, we don't know how.
To have any documentation? Is there
Yes.
So you have like...
Yes. I got 150,000 pages of evidence of the wrongdoing in the CAF on this one.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah. And as a retired nurse, I'm pretty good with medical records and researching and finding out what's going on. And yeah. So they've got a lot to answer for here because there's some tough questions coming at them for questioning.
Is there a standout story for you about the psychological impact that this has had on some of the CAF members?
I can tell you that when we started this, I expected to have suicides. I really did.
Me too.
People along the way. But we organized very quickly in October 21. We set up groups and I gave people assignments to dig up paperwork for me. We were busy with the ATIP system before they knew we were coming because we went deep and we went dark. And so we had this really cohesive group and this strong group, and I have plaintiffs from across the country. So when someone would reach out that they weren't doing well, or their spouse would reach out that they weren't doing well, I was able to tap senior veterans, and they could go and help this person. So we thank God did not have any suicides in my group. However, have we had attempts? Yes. One young man, he'd already recovered from alcoholism. He had become an advocate and a support for anyone going through any type of addiction issues. He had had 10 years of being clean with no anti-anxiety drugs. Like, he was doing really well, and he had gotten married and had bought a house and had a young child. And then this hit, and he ended up in the hospital having attempted suicide.
So the depression leading all the way to attempted suicide, how would you describe the cause of that? Is it because of the sense of betrayal from the CAF, a loss of career, like the one fellow that I'm talking about, 23 years, storied career, incredibly respected soldier, and his career is just gone and cannot possibly be revived, even if he got the job? Is it the sense of hopelessness? What is it? How would you articulate it from what you've seen?
First of all, I would say that it's the betrayal. Mm-hmm. These are people who dedicated their lives to the service of Canada. We've got combat veterans. We've got specially trained people. I have people from every branch, every trade. Chests full of medals, which you know in Canada are not easy to get.
No, they're not like the American ones where they get a they get a medal for showing up on time.
Exactly. So that they were betrayed, that they had watched, never ever imagined that their religion would be discounted. I mean, I have padres who were told their faith wasn't sincere enough to get a religious exemption. I don't know how much more sincere your belief has to be to get an exemption than being a padre in uniform.
Were there other religions? Because there's a sense, including myself and my audience, I hope respects me enough not to think I'm a maloon, but there's a sort of a mark of the beast element to this that where I'm not saying the jab is the mark of the beast, but it feels that way because the vaccine passports, you can't buy or sell. I mean, it's right out of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And it was very mark of the beast-ish. Yes. It was in that territory, and it certainly was on my mind because if you can't buy, sell, function in society without this vaccine passport, that was right out of Revelations for me. And mm-hmm. I can't even really call myself a Christian. But that is something that was certainly on my mind. So it's not difficult to imagine that a devout Christian who knows Revelations, because they've actually read it, would say, oh my gosh, this is absolutely the mark of the beast. And so I'm going to refuse to do it. Now, that was not respected. Is the mark of the beast issue, was that brought up for as the reason for the religious exemption?
For some people, yes. Okay. The other thing is that the chaplain general says there's only 25 religions. According to the Canadian Armed Forces, there's only 25 religions, which is against Canadian law, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
It's sincere belief. It's not, is this a religion that is practiced like Catholicism that recognizes the Pope? But even Catholics don't have to listen to the Pope.
Was there any other religions that, like Islam or Judaism, that was like, okay, well, we'll give the religious exemption to you if you're not okay with it? Was there any of that, or was it all religions were discounted?
It was pretty much all religions were discounted. Okay. There was a Muslim gentleman who contacted me, but there were some forms of Judaism which were considered not religions according to the 25 list of 25. Isn't that interesting? But the other point of it, Mark, is that before COVID, if you were Muslim or of Jewish faith that did not want to consume pork, you got a religious accommodation with no hassle.
What about Sikhs? When I was in didn't have to wear a beret. You could wear a turban, which I admit I wasn't too sure of then, but now I'm all for it. I think, yeah, that's a good exemption to have. Was there any examples of Sikhs saying, no, this is I would like a religious exemption on the jab?
I didn't have any Sikhs come forward to me. Okay. That's not to say that there weren't out there, because I know that there were other. There was probably 3,000 to 5,000. Actually, that said no.
3,000 to 5,000 that said no.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot. But
that's a lot
of that 3,000 to 5,000. I imagine a lot of them decided to get the jab anyway after the initial resistance.
No, these are people that said no, and they either voluntary. This is the other thing where they hid releases because they voluntarily released to avoid administrative measures.
Well, what's the calf population now? Like 60,000?
32.
Oh my God. So
we're that's what I'm getting from my sources. Gotta get information from all over, right? We're down to about 32. I don't care what CAF wants to say in the press.
Well,
we started out at around 68. We got down to around 40 about a month ago, and we're down around 32 because people aren't renewing their contracts either.
Well, I served during the dark decade. So I got in 91, out in 95, and by 2000, the CF went from 90,000 down to 60. Like, it was a slaughter. Yeah. Mostly most of us left because of horrific leadership, sense of betrayal. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of us left. But
and it's back.
Worse.
Yeah, but I would say worse. But
help me out with the math here. Mm-hmm. Between 3,000 and 5,000, let's use the small number. Let's say 3,000 hard no's, just mm-hmm. refusals. And with the CF at 32,000, that's what, 10%?
Yeah. So my estimate is they lost between 10 to 15% of their force with this mandate.
And at a time where we're desperate for recruiting because we can't get anybody to join.
Right. And if you were a business and lost 10 to 15% of your staff in one fell swoop, you'd be out of business.
Yeah.
You'd be bankrupt.
Well, we don't have a...
Let's face it. I mean, that's the truth. And they didn't lose people that they could spare. Not only were they undermanned and undergunned, as always, but the people, the ranks that they lost are the ones that train the new ones coming in.
Well, 32,000...
The sergeants... They wiped them out.
32,000 were collapsed. We do not. That means we no longer have a functioning, deployable military.
Canada at 32,000,
yeah, we Canada are defenseless. Defense. Yeah,
we have been for 2 years now.
At 32,000, we don't have a military.
Right. So here's I'll give you examples. The reason the Chinese balloon got shot down by the Americans is because we didn't have a jet to scramble. There, a few months ago, on a Friday afternoon, we had 3 jets and 3 pilots to protect our entire country. And I've talked to the snipers over there. I've physically stood there and talked to them, and there were 3 snipers for all of Western Canada.
Well, Trudeau just said, we're going to double our efforts in Latvia.
No, we're not, because we can't get enough people to fight forest fires.
Yeah.
On the way in, this morning on the news, they were talking about the fires in BC and that the Canadian military was sending a reconnaissance team to see where they could help. They're sending a reconnaissance team because they can't muster 100 soldiers to actually go and help. So call it what you will, they don't have the people. Honestly, this chief of defense staff, Wayne Eyre, will go down in history as the one who destroyed the Canadian Armed Forces. And it's going to have to rebuild from the ashes.
So
the talk about NATO, we shouldn't be in NATO. Because we can't contribute right now.
No, you're right. We don't deserve, or we don't have the capability to meet the criteria for NATO. The 5% GDP or whatever the number is, we're nowhere near that. It's going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been like that. It's interesting. I don't really talk about political parties on this show, but I have noticed that every time the Liberals are in power, the military shrinks.
Yes.
Every time. It's mm-hmm. I don't know what the hatred is exactly. Either an ideology that we don't need a military, or maybe they just hate the idea of the military. I'm not sure.
It's hard to say.
All I remember is
Trudeau 1.0 was very anti-military. If you recall the stories of when he avoided the draft, et cetera.
Well, I'm not familiar with that, but I am familiar with the mentality. When I was posted in Victoria, which is hippie central, I once asked a university girl to dance, and she looked at me, looked at my haircut when there were haircut regulations, and said, "Are you a soldier?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "I don't dance with baby killers." Well, isn't that interesting? I hadn't even been deployed, had killed zero people. But I was a baby killer in her eyes and was to be shunned without knowing a thing about me. And I think that sort of idea is really indicative of the left side of the aisle. And I think that still exists very strongly today, which is why our prime minister has missed, I don't know, out of all the years that he's been PM, how many times has he missed Remembrance Day or shown up late? Quite a few.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the infamous quote of "You're asking for more than we can give."
Yeah, that's Brock.
That's never going to be forgiven in the military and veteran community.
No,
that cut really, really deep.
When he said that to Brock Blaszczyk, I've had Brock on the show a few times. We speak fairly regularly. What was it about that comment? Do you think that cut to the core? Like, how is it that? That one gaffe stuck.
I think because there's And I know the courts turned us down when they tried to bring it in, but there's a covenant between the Canadian public and our military. They're willing to put their lives on the line, sign on the dotted line, and in return, we take care of them if they get hurt or killed when they do. And that line from Trudeau basically said, you don't matter anymore, and we're not going to support you, even if we ask you to step into a war zone. That, as a civilian, that's how I interpret it. I was like, hold on, wait a minute. If my son signs up to serve in the Canadian Armed Forces, what do you mean you don't want to take care of him? That his putting his life on the line is asking for more than the government wants to give. That's, to me, that's why it stung so deep. I was like, how dare you?
And it was who he said it to as well. Because it wasn't just a regular intact bodied veteran. Mm-hmm. You said it to Brock, who's missing one leg and the other leg is absolutely mangled.
Yeah.
And that's who he said it to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it's, well, he's famous for stepping, putting his foot in the wrong place, and he definitely did there as far as I was concerned. It just was so horrific to me to hear one of our prime ministers actually say such a thing. Completely over the line as far as I was concerned.
Well, that sort of segues us into our next topic. So as you and I were talking pre-show, I was a central character in medical assistance in dying, or euthanasia, assisted suicide, being offered to veterans right out of the blue by Veterans Affairs Canada. Now, there was an investigation, and the minister has said, oh, no, it's bullshit, it's not true. Whereas myself, and I'm not the only one, with the evidence in hand, I have the recordings, I know that it's true. And I know there wasn't an investigation, although he said that there was. There wasn't it was an investigation looking for nothing. They didn't
look
actually
try. Look over there. Look over there. Yeah. Don't look at that. Yeah.
It's like a little baby crying. Look at the keys. Look at the keys. Mm. And it is true. They were offered it. It was policy. I've done numerous episodes on it. It was VAC policy. Do I have the piece of paper saying so? No, I don't. But they also won't produce their manuals. So, I've covered this and the logic behind my assertions, as well as the evidence behind my assertions at length. And yes, it was policy of VAC to offer MAID to veterans to try to thin us out and kill as many of us as possible. That's true.
You're expensive.
Yeah, extremely expensive.
You're expensive.
Now, what has been your experience, and what would you like to do? What do you think should happen as a result, being that it's already been called case closed? It was one isolated incident, when I know that that's a big fat lie.
Yeah, well, I absolutely tell you, I knew it was more than one case. I knew this was not the first time. When the story broke, I was livid. I saw red. I was so furious because I understand veterans very well. I've spent years of my life working with veterans, and for a veteran to actually reach out and ask for help is a huge thing. And then to be offered MAID, and don't worry, we'll look after your family, your kids when you do. I was like, what? And I had, so my reaction after I got over my shock, my retired nurse in my brain got over the shock of that, was as my lawyer brain kicked in. And I would love to bring a lawsuit against the Canadian government for that exact situation.
Well, they're people calling some of the lawyers. the government is... politely called people like Christine Gauthier and others liars.
Yes.
So Plato called them liars. Say, well, yeah, she says this was offered to her, but we have no evidence because any evidence that may have been there has been buried.
Right.
Buried, exactly. Burned, thrown through the shredder.
There's lots of lawsuits out there that are potential lawsuits. I just need plaintiffs. Because I can see what's wrong. I can have all kinds of evidence that I may have collected, but if I don't have a plaintiff, I can't do anything about it because it didn't happen to me personally. And I am learning from my American colleagues, because Canadians are not known for holding our government to account. We don't have enough practice. We've only had a constitution for about 40 years. The Americans have had one for over 200. They're much better at holding their government to account. And I think that's what needs to start happening here in Canada. And I have had other lawyers reach out to me to bring civilian cases that are similar to my mass tort, now that that's broken into the media. And I think we need to start holding CAF and back to the fire and making them be accountable, because once it starts to hurt, that's when they start to change things.
Our
government's not going to voluntarily change anything.
Our Constitution and Bill of Rights, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being it is everything that it needs to be, it's rock solid, 1 being it's more open than a screen door, where is our Constitution and Bill of Rights? Is it solid or is it almost useless?
Well, prior to COVID, I'd have probably given it about a 7. And now I'd give it maybe a 2 because of the recent finding that the COVID mandates reached to Section 7 and do not survive Section 1. We need a much more robust Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And our Constitution really isn't worth the paper it's written on. And we've discovered that the hard way.
Isn't it supposed to be the ultimate law of the land?
Yes. And the problem, here's the biggest problem with constitutional law, is that Section 1, where the government can have a get-out-of-jail-free card of, well, if we can justify it, then we can do whatever we want. And that should not be there. I know they put it there in order to make the deal.
Is that the notwithstanding clause?
No, that's a different one. Okay. That's where the provinces can have a choice. They can have a year to not comply. But this is whatever's been done by the government can be justified by the government, then they can violate your rights. So I know that's exactly what they're going to try in this lawsuit for the charter breaches, is to say, well, it was an emergency, safe and effective, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, it's okay that we violated Section 7 of their bodily autonomy, because
the argument that they're going to make is... The argument that they're going to make is that all soldiers must be deployable. They all must be operational. And if this jab, if you didn't take the jab, you were not operational.
So then why weren't they all 3B releases? Because they didn't meet universality of service.
Exactly.
They didn't do that. And how many people serving in the CAF right now can't deploy? For various reasons. They've been operating with non-deployable people for decades because they need the numbers.
Yeah.
How many clerks couldn't deploy? How many people couldn't pass the fitness test?
Well, where's the evidence that this would make somebody undeployable? Where's the science?
Because I'll give you an example. For years, people have been refusing the flu shots and they were still deployed.
Ah, I did not know that. So there was...
I've got people that have never received any who have been in uniform for years. That wasn't an issue before.
Zero vaccines?
Zero, yeah.
And they've been deployed?
Yeah, they were dagged green.
Wow.
So what made this any different? That's the question they're going to have to answer, I guess.
So there is something special that did make it different. What do you think that is?
Politics. And I'll tell you why I think that. So when the vaccines came in, General Vance was Chief of Defense Staff, and he did not bring in a mandate. Then we all know what happened to General Vance. He's accused of sexual misconduct. So they bring in Admiral MacDonald. Admiral MacDonald, I have his briefing note that he was given on mandates. It says it couldn't be done. Legally, medically, morally, ethically, you name it. You can't do this. So he didn't do it. A few weeks later, sexual misconduct. Then we have General Fortune, who's in charge of the civilian rollouts. No mandate in the civilian world. He gets out on sexual misconduct, which he has now successfully defeated. Admiral MacDonald as well. Then we have a briefing note written to the acting chief of defense staff, Wayne Eyre, written by General Cadieux, that says you cannot do this medically, legally, morally, ethically, etc. Then we have the mandate brought in. General Cadieux is routed out with sexual misconduct allegations, which she is fighting.
So what are the odds that four in a row?
Yep. And what happens to Eyre a few weeks after he brings in the directive? He goes from acting CDS to full CDS. He gets a promotion. Topshi brings in a third booster mandate in the Royal Canadian Navy. He gets named commander of the Navy. Don't tell me there's no politics involved in these decisions. And I have documentation that shows that Eyre says that he couldn't say no because it came from above him.
So isn't that illegal right there?
Yeah, it better have come from the king or the governor general, because if it came from the prime minister's office, that's an illegal order. That's an unlawful order.
So illegal where? Criminal code, constitution? Like, how is it illegal that
National Defense Act.
So the National Defense Act says that the
You don't take orders from the prime minister's office.
Okay. Now, how the National Defense Act, how enforceable is that? Is it wishy-washy like our Constitution and Bill of Rights, or is it ironclad?
It's law. It's law, so it hasn't been defeated. The Crown would have to defeat that law, or the government would have to change that act for it to no longer be enforced. I mean, when you swear your oath, who do you swear your oath to? The monarch.
Yeah, to the monarch and their heirs. Yeah.
As a lawyer, I swear to the monarch and their heirs.
Yeah.
Because we are outside the government of Canada. Our roles are to protect the people of Canada from our government.
And if we were a constitutional democracy like our neighbors to the south, then we would be. That's why they swear an oath to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Right.
Because that doesn't waver. It doesn't change with every election.
Right. They're a republic. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And so our prime minister is not the commander in chief. The king is, and the governor general stands in place.
So accepting an order from the Prime Minister is a breach of the National Defense Act. What about the Prime Minister? Is the Prime Minister in the breach of the National Defense Act by making an order in the first place?
Good question. I would say yes.
So
he went way over his powers there. But
again,
the Chief of Defense Staff should have stood up and said, no.
Because it was an unlawful order. So,
I have a suspicion that that's what Vance and McDonald said. No, I don't take orders from you.
Well, our PM has not been held to task for any other crime that he's committed. For right. this one, let's say that this is a crime, and it was a crime against the National Defense, in violation of the National Defense Act, committed by our Prime Minister by attempting to order the CDS around. What would be the, according to the National Defense Act, what's the potential? I mean, I know it's never going to happen, but what would be the, if it was any other human being, what's the potential penalties for the Prime Minister? Could this be jail time? If so, how much?
Well, if the Department of Justice, Attorney General, chose to bring criminal charges for, inciting something to be done unlawfully, then yeah, you could look at jail time. General Eyre, it could be looking at a court martial, because the National Defense Act for serving member is a service offense is a court martial.
If the law,
the trouble is, who's his peers?
Well, that's it.
And that's one of the things we want to address in the lawsuit, is that final authority for grievances against this was him, against his own order.
So if the law doesn't apply to all, if the law doesn't apply to all equal mm-hmm. under the law, which we clearly are not, are we actually a democracy?
No. So in February, I was in court under a different matter, not related to this at all. And the Crown stood up and said, this court has no jurisdiction over the Chief of Defense Staff in military matters. And I watched the justice's face, and I watched his eyebrow rise, and I thought, oh boy, are we going to settle that question? Because basically the Crown stood up and said, nobody can touch the Chief of Defense Staff. He's above the law. I don't know about you, but a military with a leader who says he's above the law is a pretty scary thing.
Well, there's no precedent for that. I know that if you get charged with a crime as a CF member, there's a couple of different options. The military route, you can do 2 years less a day at Club Ed. And for those that don't know, Club Ed is the military prison in Edmonton. I love that they call it Club Ed. All these little sayings that we have are awesome. So you can do 2 years less a day. If the crime, however, requires a sentence beyond 2 years, then you go to a civilian jail under the civilian system. Mm-hmm. And that's how that works. So we're not exempt. And it sounds to me that several senior members should at least be charged so that and given a chance to defend themselves in court, but they're not even being charged.
Well, here's the catch. In Canada, you don't bring charges as a citizen.
The Crown does.
The Crown has to bring the charges. Yeah. So that's what's going to protect them. However, there is such a thing known as a private prosecution in Canada. Very rare, but it can happen. And I have brought a private prosecution that was deemed to be of merit, and the Crown took it over. And that was the case of the soldier in Edmonton who tried to kill her children. I was dad's lawyer. Still am dad's lawyer. And when it was ignored by the chief, by the NIS, the National Investigation Service for the Canadian Forces, and the MPs, we went ahead and did our own investigation, gathered a whole bunch of evidence, and were proceeding to lay charges under a private prosecution when the Crown kind of woke up, took it over, and CFNIS finally did their job. But it took 8 years to get her convicted. And she would not have even been charged if it hadn't been for us pushing it.
I've heard of this private prosecution. I didn't know if it was real or not. So thank you for clarifying that.
It's rare, but it can happen.
Well, okay. How many private prosecutions that you're aware of actually resulted in jail time?
I can tell you just the one that I know of when she got 10 years.
Okay. So insanely rare then.
Yes. Yes.
But not impossible.
Well, because most people don't know it exists. Most lawyers don't know it exists. Let's be really honest. Most lawyers don't even know it exists in Canada that you can do this. Everyone very much assumes that our criminal justice system is pretty close to the U.S. It's not. For instance, you can't have a lawyer with you while you're being questioned by police. You can ask to speak to a lawyer, but if the lawyer's
Oh, it froze on me. Oh. Oh, you're back. It's not like the movies in the States.
Nope.
You can't have a lawyer in the room with you.
But you can't have a lawyer in the room with you. You're on your own, which is why, you know, the first advice I give anyone who's even might be investigated is shut up.
Yeah, keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. If they ask, especially in the military, because you can be ordered to attend to the MPs or CFNIS.
STFU. Yeah. Shut the F up.
So it's like name, service number. Am I being detained? No. Have a nice day and walk out. And they're like, I can't walk out. Yes, you can.
Am I being charged? Am I being detained?
You have rights as a citizen of Canada to walk out of there and not be questioned. Yeah. If they say, yes, you're being detained, then I want to talk to my lawyer and not another word. So, yeah, it's an interesting perspective. And, of course, the first thing people's instincts are when they're being questioned is to, well, I'm innocent and this is why, and give them all this. Well, they're trying to get you to talk because they'll twist your words. You want a perfect example? Watch Russell Williams' interrogation. Brilliantly done. And he cracked really fast.
So for those that don't know, Russell Williams was a Air Force colonel, I believe, was his rank, who was a serial killer, rapist, freaky sicko.
I think he's got a lot more victims than nobody knows about around the world.
They usually do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they usually do.
So, that's a good example of how a good interrogator will, you know. I often say to my people if they've been deployed, you know, that resistance training you were taught, if you got captured, use that. That's what makes representing military, a bit of a pleasure for me because I can use examples such as that.
So,
you know, training.
I know of a few different lawyers who had served in the military, actually both that come to mind. Rory Fowler and Philip Miller. They both served in the infantry and then became army lawyers and are now civilian lawyers. So that, you know, that's a path that makes sense. How did you get into this area of law? And I imagine you had to learn military law as well.
Mm-hmm. So I went to law school at the U of A here in Edmonton, and there was a military law class offered. It was taught by a retired JAG and an active duty JAG. And I took it because I thought it would be really interesting to learn. And they said to me, please do something related to the military. Now, I had went to law school because I'd suffered quite a severe back injury as a nurse. So I went to a law school on workers' compensation, which is why I have a passion for VAC, because I won against workers' compensation, and my pay it forward is to win against VAC. So I realized that there was very different, it's a very different life. It's a very different juxtaposition between two sets of laws. You've got military law and civilian law, which apply to these people. So I thought, well, I'm going to open a practice and just take military and veterans for clients. I was told I was crazy. I was told that there was no business for me. I would be broke with no clients, and that they didn't need anyone different to represent their interests anyway. I chose not to believe that. I articled with a retired light colonel who had been infantry, who went to become a JAG, and his wife, when she retired, she had been a nurse, and then she was a tanker with the Strats, and she became a lawyer. And the guy in the office next to me, a year ahead of me in law school, was from the Navy. So I went and articled there, got my military speak up to par, and then I hung my own shingle as soon as I was called to the bar. And then within 10 days, I had lots of clients. I haven't advertised in years. And have more work than I know what to do with, because they did need somebody that could represent them and talk. And I kind of am that bridge. When I go into court, I'm that bridge between the military world and the civilian world, because judges most times are not veterans, so they don't have any clue about things. And here in Edmonton, at the King's Bench, I'm quite known. I'll go and say my client is a member of the Canadian Armed Forces, and the justices will go, yes, we know, carry on. So that, and I really enjoy my clients. I wouldn't trade them for anything. I really, really enjoy this type of law and the people that I represent, because most are really good people. There's always a few bad apples in every barrel, but mostly I'm representing really upstanding people that deserve a voice in the court, because you can't talk when you're in uniform.
No, you keep your damn mouth shut.
You're dead, but I'm not in the chain of command. I can talk all I want. Much to the chagrin of Ottawa, I'm sure.
Very, very much so. Last thing mm-hmm. that they want is resistance. Mm-hmm. Do you have cases against Veterans Affairs Canada that you're representing?
Yes, I do. Okay. I've done veterans work pretty much from the start. And right now, one of the big cases that I'm building is with vaccine injuries, because they're not recognizing them as service related. So I am building that, because they're denying those claims. And and of course, with my nursing background, I can go through a medical file and find, I had one guy come to me for his knee, and I sat down with him and said, you have 8 claims, not just the one. And he went, no, I don't. And I said, yeah, you remember when you cracked your head against the lav? He went, yeah, we all do that. I said, yeah, well, you have an x-ray here, and that's called a brain injury that's compensatable by VAC. He went, no, it happens to everybody. I said, I don't care if it happens to everybody. It's still a claim. So I'm happy to work with some of the veterans. And if they need an appeal, I encourage them to go to the Bureau of Pension Advocates. But if they've reached that point where they just don't trust any person related to VAC, then I can do appeals. But if the appeal fails, then you have to move it to the federal court. And that's my bailiwick. That's where I'm comfortable representing.
So there are, in the veteran community, there's different opinions of VAC. Some say, hey, it's great. I've had a great experience with them, although those are not very abundant. Most find that VAC acts like an insurance company, that they do everything that they can to say no. They start at no and make you like Sisyphus going up the hill, that big rock, trying more roadblocks than you can believe. It's a huge mountain to climb to get them to yes. But so they start it to you to know and make you prove beyond, like, beyond.
Well, and to, making people to get them to yes. prove that their limbs are still missing years later to just keep the benefits.
Yeah, that's been called an urban myth. But I just had Tommy Anderson on the show the other day, and for 29 years, because he lost both legs and an eyeball on my tour. And yeah, every year. And if you don't fill out that piece of paperwork that says, oh yeah, my legs haven't grown back, because he did miss it one year. He was a little bit late getting that filled out. They cut him off. They cut him off his benefits, and it took a while to get him to get that going again.
Yeah, I know it's really something to see. And then you know, the ones that have an easy experience usually have a really good case manager that has some compassion, and those case managers don't tend to last very long, because that's the other frustration, is they can be doing really well, have a really good relationship with a case manager, and then all of a sudden they're not there anymore, and they have to deal with the next person and tell their story all over again. It's very similar to how workers' compensation works for civilians. It's a very similar experience.
I think I went through 4 caseworkers in 3 years, and that's the norm.
Yeah, I got a few fired on my work, my own workers' compensation claim. I was my own first. It was my own first client, is what I often say, because they stepped over the line, and I knew that they'd stepped over the line as a nurse. You know, they were diagnosing what was going on instead of what the specialists were doing. You know, and my reaction was, oh, congratulations, you've gone to medical school and you've become a specialist since in the 6 weeks since I last talked to you. Congratulations. Because if I did what you just did, I'd lose my license as a nurse. Click.
I just got there's quite a few comments popping up in the comment column here. One of them is Tom Anderson, who I've mentioned like 4 times. And he says he's left a message. I don't know if you've got back to him yet or not. So
I'll have to look.
Hopefully get that done today. Tommy, I got you, buddy. I got you. All right.
We're a very popular office.
busier than a one-armed roofer in a snowstorm.
Yep.
So what are some of the biggest myths, toxic myths that are out there about veterans' rights and... how am I supposed to word this? What's some of the bullshit that you've been hearing that gets pushed by the media that simply isn't true? Like, what are some of the high flyers of just untruths out there, misinformation and disinformation being propagated by the government that you have to contend with?
I think, first of all, the biggest myth is that our veterans are taken care of. That don't worry, everything's taken care of. We really look after them when something's going wrong. That's got to be the biggest myth out there. When I tell people about what happens to a lot of veterans when they try to reach out, they're shocked that they were treated that way. The other big myth is that veterans get a fortune, that you know, they're getting all these millions of dollars from Veterans Affairs and they never have to work again, et cetera, et cetera. The cap for a catastrophic injury for VAC is $360,000. That's not even close to what you would get if you were injured in a car accident and, you know, lost your legs in a car accident. You would get a lot more money than $360,000. The other myth, I think, is that... people aren't aware, veterans aren't aware of what extra benefits they can get. I see this in, there's a Veterans Affairs chat group on Signal that I pop into now and then. And that's probably the biggest one. They don't even realize what's available for them. And that's a fault between the CAF when they're releasing and then Veterans Affairs when they get there. Because if they have a case manager who doesn't say to them, well, what about this and what about this? They don't even know to apply for benefits that they are actually entitled to.
The excuse that they use is that it's all on the website. It's all on veterans.gc.ca. Well, right. For me to sign into my VAC account, well, just get a my VAC account. For me to sign in, it's actually gotten worse instead of better. It used to be 11 clicks, like 11 steps. Now I think it's 15. So for me just to read a blessed email, 15. And there's no, there's nothing that I can click on that says, yeah, I don't need all the security. Just send it to my regular email. There's nothing I can click on to bypass it. So I have to go through 15 steps every time I want to just read an email. And, it's really something else. Yeah. I want to go to one of the questions here.
And not all veterans have that ability to access it online.
No. Well, one of the common symptoms of PTSD is that you're easily overwhelmed by anxiety, easily overwhelmed by administrative burden. So 15 steps to read a damned email is too much, which is why, although the odd person may game the system, I'm sure that's true, but it's very, very rare from my experience. What is far more common is people that never enter the system because it's just too intimidating. So
I see lots of that.
Benefits where, that have never been applied for. So Arnold Murphy has asked me a question here. I don't know what it means, but it's interesting. I wanted to ask you. Charter S.7 is continuously violated. I don't even know what that is. And he was asking for, do you know what he's talking about?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. Liberty. Section 7, the quickest one I can give you off the top of my head is liberty of your personal, liberty of your person. So that's sort of your bodily autonomy one, catch-all.
Okay.
Under Section 7. And it is always frequently violated in Canada. As long as they can justify it, they can get away with it.
So, and then so what happens when the justification, like it's safe and effective, when that is later proven to be false, that no, this does not stop the spread, because that's been proven, it does not stop the spread, and doesn't save your life, and it doesn't stop anybody else from getting it, so...
Doesn't save grandma,
it does none of these things that we were promised that it does. So when that comes out, that actually they knew that in the beginning... Is that part of the lawsuit? I was like, well, no, you did know that it does nothing, but you said it did something and you forced them to get it without any reason, without any true reason. You stated, you said that this is your reason, but we know that that is simply not true.
Right. So, yeah, and that's what's going to have to be determined in the court is the fact that they knew and did it anyway.
They knew and did it anyway. Do you trust the courts?
So now our courts could come back and just say, oh, well, it was an emergency, decisions being made quickly, they did the best they could at the time. That's probably where the Crown's going to go. It's going to be interesting to see where our courts go. Our courts are very liberal. The legal profession is very liberal. There's probably only a handful of lawyers that are even willing to touch anything related to COVID in Canada. This is why I didn't bring a COVID-19 lawsuit. This is why the lawsuit's about abuse of power, because I knew I wouldn't be able to bring a COVID-19.
Is having the Great Barrington Declaration, is that part of your argument? The Great Barrington Declaration?
I've never heard of it, so no.
Oh, well, it should be, perhaps, may I suggest. So the Great Barrington Declaration started in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, I think. Say that three times fast. And it was I forget the name of the guy, the Trish Wood podcast has had him on, the guy that started it all. But it is a signatory where experts from around the world, and I don't know what the number is, I think it's somewhere north of 40,000 experts, epidemiologists, virologists, etc., all signed this documentation saying, look, the studies have been done. Masking does not help you. And here's all the science that says it does nothing. And it's funny because military training, we've all done the gas chamber, and we know that if you don't have a seal around your face, it doesn't do anything. It's still going to get in there. And yet we think a face diaper is going to do something. It's like, well, no, we all know that we've been trained in the science and we still don't
understand. I'll give you an example. In the 90s, scrubbing into the OR, we quit wearing masks because we weren't preventing respiratory-borne infection to the patient by wearing a mask, which was why we were supposedly wearing them. We went back to wearing masks to protect ourselves from blood and body fluids.
Yeah, the only point of a mask, it's called a surgical mask for a reason. It's a surgical mask because it's meant for surgery so that you don't, if you say it, don't spray it into an open wound. And that's all it is.
No, that's the masks don't work for that either. What it's doing is protecting the healthcare personnel from your blood and body fluids. Because once you breathe into that mask for a few seconds, it becomes wet and there's no protection for someone around you.
Okay. So,
and we knew that back in the 90s when I was scrubbing in the OR. So
I thought that was just so you don't sneeze into an open wound.
Not really. It's to protect you from HIV, Hep B, all the blood and body fluid.
Okay.
I learned something. That's why you have to wear eye protection too.
Well,
it's not to protect the patient from you crying in the wound, is to protect you from what's spraying at you.
Well, the Great Barrington Declaration basically says that masking doesn't work, and here's the science. The study's been gone, forever. Though you know, there's over 200 studies, and they also say that you cannot vaccinate your way out of this pandemic. You cannot. Mm-hmm. So it says both things. So social distancing, all these things, lockdowns, they don't work. And we have, here's the science, the actual and historical data over the last 80 years proving that it does not work.
Right.
So that's the Great Barrington Declaration and all the sanitaries.
And don't you think the Surgeon General should have the resources and the knowledge to have read that?
Well, you would think so. Well, it's funny because in May of 2019, I personally read the an article that was published by the CDC of all places. This is back in May of 2019. I don't know why it caught my eye at the time, but saying masks do not work to prevent respiratory illnesses. They just don't for so many reasons. You can boil it down to is you can't put up a chain link fence to keep out the mosquitoes.
Right.
That's pretty much what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we still see people wearing masks in public, in the sunshine, out
alone in their cars,
protecting them from absolute, and actually causing more upper respiratory illnesses because of the bacteria that collects and is grown. And it's like a petri dish on your face.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bacterial culture that you're making on your face that's doing more harm than good.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about masking, I think about our pilots, especially our fighter pilots, that are they're wearing a mask that's in their own respiratory system. They're not breathing air to anyone else. And they grounded those pilots if they wouldn't take the vaccine. they weren't a danger to anyone. They're 35,000 feet in the air with their own respiratory system working. So, I mean, it just never made any sense to me at all, to be honest.
As part of your argument,
I knew that the masks weren't doing anything, especially the cloth masks. Like, okay, you want me to wear one? I'll do it because that will, you know, get me peacefully into the courtroom and back out again. But it's not doing anything.
One of the greatest sources that you can find to build your case for expert witnesses is the Trish Wood podcast. Trish Wood was 60 Minutes, the Fifth Estate. She was one of the reporters from then that she went on her own. But she has experts all the time, epidemiologists, everything else, saying basically what we're saying. Mm-hmm. And that people that know the science backwards and forwards and can prove it. So if you need expert witnesses, just go through give Trish a call and say, here's my wish list.
I was at the COVID litigators conference in Atlanta in March.
Okay.
So I met some of these people in person, Robert Malone, Dr. Corey. So that it was excellent to be in a room full of lawyers and doctors that were all saying, hold on a minute. We had a severe infraction of our rights and this shouldn't have happened. I'm very disappointed in my own legal community, because if we take COVID out of it and put anything else in there and the government tried to do what they did, they'd be screaming. Mm-hmm. There should be. And the day the Emergencies Act came in, my heart stopped. Most people have no idea what the government did that day. They took away everything we have. Everything about your life was taken away from you. It was short-lived, so you didn't feel it. But that was a horrible day in Canada's history, that they felt justified to strip us of everything.
Across the country because of what was happening in Ottawa.
Right. And peacefully happening in Ottawa. That was like, how could people, it still boggles my mind that people see that as some big protest that was seriously impacting anything. It blocked a few streets in Ottawa in the middle of winter.
Yeah, and really. Of course, honking. I mean, so scary.
Honking, yeah.
Scary, scary
and they
honking.
They quit. When they were asked to quit, they quit.
Yeah. One of the names that you mentioned, Dr. Robert Malone, prior to the pandemic, was hailed as this incredible expert and this paragon of knowledge among the scientific community, and is the inventor or one of the inventors of mRNA vaccine technology. He's the guy that built it. And as soon as he started putting up any resistance and saying, well, hey, I invented the thing and this is not how you're supposed to use it at all. It was something that we thought we should, you know, look at as see if maybe this is viable, but it's not viable, and this is why it's not viable. And I invented it.
Attaching the nanoprotein to it too, nanolipids, to it as well, made it even worse.
So he's been maligned left, right, and center, where he was previously hailed. The same happened to Dr. Dennis Modry, who I met when I was 29 years old when I needed heart surgery, because he was the heart surgeon for the province of Alberta, number one guy. And people were falling at his feet, worshiping the guy, you know, and the government of Alberta was so proud that they had the doctor that did the first transplant in Alberta, heart transplant, right? They just loved Dr. Modry until he started quoting the actual science, and then, now he's a conspiracy nut. He's a terrible human being. Have you suffered that as well? And if so, from where?
Since the mass tort came out, it's been interesting. Some of the trolls, I'm a tinfoil hat lawyer. We jokingly, like I said, we got a great group. We jokingly say the aluminum foil is better because we can change the shape and make it look better. Last week, we all had a very good laugh because apparently the 330 are part of the Canadian equivalent of QAnon. Patriots that are going to completely change Canada. Just hold on. We're coming. We're going to be leading the charge. Which is interesting because I have people who are plaintiffs who have worked in PSYOPs for the military. Mm-hmm. And we had a very good laugh because they're like, oh, this is right out of the textbook.
Sure.
discredit what we're saying.
Counterintelligence propaganda, COINTELPRO.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, making us look like we're crazy, or that these are just a bunch of troublemakers. We all did it when we were younger. Like, what's the problem?
Yeah.
And the problem, like, as much as there's problems with the vaccine, that there's vaccine injuries and deaths, the crux of this lawsuit that's before the courts now is what the chain of command did with it. The tactics
that are being used against you and others like you are the exact same as abusive narcissists in a relationship. Yes. So an abusive narcissist in a relationship will do crazy making. Mm-hmm. So the gaslighting, and all to maintain control. Yes. It's all about control. And if they feel that they're losing control, they will do anything they can. They will call you any names that they can to maintain the control. Because that's what an abusive narcissist does.
Yes.
And now here we are on a national level where we are all the victims of abusive narcissists, because that's our government. That's our government on a macro level.
Prime minister for sure.
Well, there's no question that he has narcissistic tendencies, and mm-hmm. that's from any reasonable observation. I mean, how else do you say it? And just look how abusive he is to women in his cabinet. How he screams at women in his cabinet. This feminist mm-hmm. that screams at women that work for him. Screams or at them.
Has allegations of abusing women outside his cabinet, too.
Well, there's that.
You know?
Last question. Tom Anderson brought it up because it happened on our tour. There has been, since Agent Orange in the States, Agent Orange was also used in CFB Gagetown, yes. and eventually something came of that. But there was also the Red Sand in Croatia when I was there. Mm-hmm. And basically, transformers and other PCB-laden toxic material covered by sand. And then knowing that that's what was under the pile, we were forced, and I was one of the people that was forced to do it. Of course, we didn't find out till after the fact. We were digging in the sandbox with the toxic sand. And then we filled these sandbags, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, and we lived in them because that was our fortification. Now, just lost a friend to cancer a couple months ago. Who was there, and several others with all kinds of health issues as a result. But when I asked about it the first time for Veterans Affairs, they sent me a depleted uranium test kit. It's like, depleted uranium? This is PCBs. These are two different things. Mm-hmm. So are you aware of that, and is it just too long ago to do anything about it?
There's a potential that it was too long ago. However, I should let you know that recently came across my desk in the last couple of weeks is a class action lawsuit that's going to be developed relating to environmental harms to members of the Canadian Armed Forces, from lead in the water at toxic levels. I forget the name of it, but there was a fire retardant that was sprayed all over CFB Edmonton. It contaminates everything. Hantavirus, all kinds, asbestos, all these things. So just out of curiosity, I had one of my people ask for environmental safety reports from Canadian bases for the past 10 years. And the reason that I was A-tipping this information is I was going to, my part of my argument was going to be the COVID 19 virus wasn't any worse than what people deal with every day on the base. The person from AATIP came back and said, just to start giving us that information, now this is for the last 10 years, that's not anything past that, was going to take them 33 years to get started. There's that much problem with environmental contamination with veterans and members of the Canadian Armed Forces right now.
Anybody that's drinking water from a water buffalo, you know, this will probably kill me.
Yeah, well, the interview I had last week, I discovered that I shouldn't have been drinking coffee from the Tim Hortons at the base at Edmonton.
Well, that's probably good advice.
Or drinking a drink with ice made out of the tap water at the golf course.
We always joked about aluminum pot syndrome.
Yeah. But. So there's that. And then there's also, I've got a separate class action starting on hearing, because it's not just that the hearing protection was defective. It turns out that there's a chemical in diesel fuel and jet fuel that causes physical damage to your hearing.
The veterans. A couple of questions ago, I said this is the last question.
It's not just about COVID in my office. We've got everything.
We're at an hour and a half, Catherine. How are you doing for time?
I can do another 15. We're good.
Okay. Veterans Charter 2006. Mm-hmm. Are things better or worse because of 2006? Was it better before 2006, or is it better now? Or both?
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. The good news was that they went back to giving veterans a choice of whether to take a big payout or whether to accept it as a pension. The weakness I have with it is that veterans are getting paid less than someone who is a civilian who gets injured and is covered by workers' compensation. The compensation piece of it should be at least the same, if not more, given that the dangers that people face in uniform that are unique. I don't think it's improved VAC very much. If that was the goal, was to make VAC more accessible or, God forbid, easier to achieve a claim, then it didn't work.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I wish they had won their lawsuit, actually, to be honest.
Well, it's incredible. Are there still active lawsuits against, between veterans and governments and the government? There's got to be all kinds of active lawsuits still. Because there's that was when Brock was told, you're asking for more than we can give. It was because when Trudeau got in, he says, we will never fight our veterans in court. Well, that's not true.
It's not true.
Any idea about
there
how
would
many?
There would be no need for me other than to write the statement of claim and then they pay it out. I mean,
any idea how many lawsuits are going on between veterans and the government right now?
I have no idea.
Dozens?
Got to be dozens. The Mefloquin one alone. I know that there's a few of those out there.
Are you involved with the Mefloquin lawsuit?
I'm not. No. Okay. But I do know people who were on. We were airborne, that were on the plane, that were handed out these mystery pills and told to take them.
So here's another for the audience who doesn't know. So Mefloquin poisoning, a real thing. Mefloquin poisoning, and there's no treatment for it that we're aware of. Just absolutely crippling. It's like PTSD on steroids. Horrific. And it was something else that people were forced to take. No option. You don't take the Mefloquin, out you go. But it did massive harm. Not to everybody. Some people, it's like a lot of things. Some people, hey, when you have cilantro, to me it tastes like soap. To you, it probably tastes wonderful. But for some people, it tastes like soap. Everybody's different. And same with different vaccines. For some people, no problem. You could have 20 of them every year. And no problem, because you can flush out toxins and heavy metals. Well, some people can't flush out toxins and heavy metals, so it hurts them or kills them. So we're not all the same. We're all different. And we all have different allergies, different tolerances. We're all different. Mm-hmm. So Mefloquin is one of those things. Mefloquin, some people could tolerate it, had absolutely no issues. Other people, it wrecked their life. Mm-hmm. And so we can't say it didn't happen to me, so it shouldn't happen to you. Well, that's just not how it works. Would you agree with that, Catherine?
I would agree.
Being a former medical professional?
And the sad part of it is that they didn't learn from the Mefloquin one. Yeah. Because when they were handing out those pills to the guys on their way to Somalia, that was the human trial. And it's, you know, it's right there in the QR notes. You're not to use military personnel to experiment on.
And for those who don't know, QR knows is military law. So Queen's Regulations and Orders.
Yeah, they haven't caught up to call it King's Regulations and Orders yet.
Yeah, it's so KRNO.
But then there's also a policy that you're not supposed to vaccinate pregnant women with anything.
And yet
at all.
Pregnant women were hiding.
They were hiding because men in uniform were hounding them at their office. One girl got charged with AWOL because her obstetrician put her in the hospital. And her chain of command charged her with AWOL.
While she was in the hospital.
While she's in the hospital for a high-risk pregnancy. I'm like, what? Excuse me?
Yeah, so much for informed consent.
Yeah, and the Canada I live in, men in uniform don't show up saying, sign these papers, you know? I can hear a newborn baby crying in the background, and there's men downstairs in uniform want me to sign some papers. What do I do? And you just keep talking to me till they go away.
Yeah, make the bad man go away.
Unbelievable. I didn't, honestly, when they first approached me back in October 21, I didn't think that they had a case they could bring. And then I started hearing the stories. It was like, okay, I got to get put on my creative brain. Let's think outside the box and how can I bring this before the courts for the behavior of the chain of command? And so that's where we are.
For anybody listening that was offered medical assistance in dying by Veterans Affairs and would like to do something about it, please get a hold of Catherine Christensen so she can put together a class action suit. I'm going to reach out to the names that I know, and Catherine, Blake Richards knows more of the names than anybody else on the planet that I'm aware of, because he was even more of a center point than I was. So Blake has a better list than I do. But if you were offered medical assistance in dying by Veterans Affairs Canada and would like to do something about it, the only way, unfortunately, is a lawsuit because of discovery. When discovery happens, the documents have to be produced. Because I can promise you, and I know firsthand, there was no RCMP investigation, as was claimed, because I started my own RCMP investigation, which went putter, putter, plop. And it just disappeared, and I haven't heard back from the Mounties, who said they were very interested in pursuing this. But, of course, we're not, because they're federal. They have federal overlords.
And they had a commissioner who was very firmly in the Liberal camp.
Well, that's exactly right.
That became very obvious in her testimony at various things.
Yeah, absolutely. Catherine, I can't even believe it's been an hour 34, probably the fastest hour 34 I've ever had in the history of the show. And I think this is episode 304. But thank you so much for being on here. And I hope I haven't lost any listeners because of this. I mean, I'm just saying what I believe. And we're just talking about stuff here. If you think I'm nuts, if you think Catherine is nuts, well, that's okay. Like, we're allowed to be nuts, aren't we? You know, if I'm wrong, educate me. Don't hate me.
Yeah. And I believe in free speech. You don't have to like what I say. I don't have to like what you say, but I won't deny you your right to say it.
Well, that's the problem with our society is that if somebody disagrees with us, I hate you. Wait a second. Hang on. You hate people that disagree with you. Why do you have to hate them?
We need to cancel you because you're not saying what I agree with. Well, no, that's not how free speech works.
No, that
is speech. If you want to say something, you go right ahead. I don't have to agree with it, but I won't deny you your right to say it.
Well, mature adults can can share opposing opinions without hating each other. If you can't do that, you're not an adult. You just aren't. Right. Not intellectually and emotionally anyway. Catherine, please stay on the line, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Operation Tango Romeo, the Trauma Recovery Podcast with Catherine Christensen of Valor Law. Valor spelled the Canadian way, V-A-L-O-U-R, which keeps coming up on spell check as wrong, but it's not wrong. It's right. Thank you for joining me, all you beautiful souls. Please click like and subscribe. That's how you can support the show. If you enjoyed this, if you found value in this show or any of my other episodes, please help me help others by clicking like and subscribe, and better yet, leave a Google review. Please do that and help others find the help that they need. You're listening to Operation Tango Romeo. Hello, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Operation Tango Romeo, the Trauma Recovery Podcast for veterans, first responders, and their families. We are on a mission to save lives and relieve pain by making help for PTS injuries easily accessible, with a vision of a world where the path to recovery is clear. Please support this mission by subscribing to and rating the show on your favorite podcast channel, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Anchor, or anywhere else. By doing so, you'll help others find the help which just might save their life. Also, please help by sharing a link to the show on all of your social media channels every time a new episode drops. And always remember to recover out loud.